Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of how much Daesh, or the self-declared Islamic State, is being destroyed and degraded following the killing of the group's number two operative by U.S. Special Forces, at the same time that Assad's forces, along with Hezbollah and Russian air power, have retaken the ancient city of Palmyra, while Iraqi government forces are poised to recapture Mosul. Richard Barrett, a director of the Sufan Group, who sits on the board of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague, joins us to discuss the extent to which Daesh is being squeezed, or whether that will mean they are more likely to strike out at soft targets in Europe. Then, with Wisconsin emerging as the next key state and a must-win for both Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz, we will speak with Joel Rogers, a professor of law, political science, public affairs, and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he directs COWS, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. He joins us to discuss the intense campaigning ahead of the critical primary a week from next Tuesday and whether the state's favorite son, Paul Ryan, who is coyly waiting in the wings, might emerge as the solution to the panicked Republican establishment's painful choices as they find themselves torn between the unlikable Cruz and the uncontrollable Trump. Then finally, we'll examine the economic agendas of the leading candidates that, with insults and scandal dominating the headlines, has not received much attention given the well-worn adage in elections it's the economy, stupid. Robert Johnson, the executive director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a former chief economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee, joins us to discuss whether the awareness of how much the American people are being screwed that Trump and Sanders are bringing forth in this election could be followed up by concrete steps to change America from increasingly oligarchical rule to renewed democratic governance. And joining us now is Richard Barrett, a director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington, and was a coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring teams at the United Nations. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Barrett.
Thank you very much.
And the president has often talked about that he's going to degrade and destroy ISIS or Daesh or the Islamic State. It's pretty extraordinary to think that we can't even agree on what the name of the public enemy number one is. But notwithstanding, is the president proving good to his word?
Well, there's no doubt that the Islamic State has both lost a lot of territory and lost a lot of men, too, for that matter. And not only have the most senior financier been killed recently, and as well as the most senior military commander a couple of weeks ago, but also there's an estimate now that about 10,000 fighters belonging to the Islamic State have also been killed over the last year or so. So that's quite a large number. And I imagine their army, the troops they can deploy, are not very much more than about 30,000 perhaps. So it's quite significant.
And the
I think, in short, in answer to your question, the Islamic State is certainly being degraded, both in Iraq, mainly by Americans with some help from Kurdish and Iraqi forces, and in Syria, where now even the Syrian government and Russian support is helping the coalition beat up the Islamic State.
So the fact that the U.S. Special Forces were able to fly in on helicopters and lay down an ambush on a remote road and know that the number two, the financier of Daesh, would be driving along this road, and then apparently they wanted to capture him rather than kill him, but there was a shootout and he was killed, would indicate that the U.S. has pretty good intelligence. I imagine it's the signals intelligence where they find out what the perhaps by intercepting cell phone traffic or something. What's your understanding of how that raid was able to be carried off because of apparently they had pretty good intelligence?
Yes, I think the intelligence picture has been improving steadily over the months, and certainly that has contributed to these actually quite daring raids, which I don't think would be attempted were it not for very, very accurate intelligence, because, of course, the public tolerance of American casualties is probably not very high. And certainly I don't think the president wants to suggest that he's putting in a lot of troops now into the theater. So yes, the intelligence is good. And it will be, as you say, communications intelligence. It will be the result of many drones going over the area and the visual intelligence that provides. And also, I imagine, from some sort of penetration and human intelligence, because to know precisely who's in charge of what, to know where they are at any given time, what their plans are, you require generally rather more than communications intelligence, because that only gives you some of the picture, and quite probably they're pretty careful about what they say on the telephone and so on.
But this cache of documents from Daesh that I believe the Syrian opposition got their hands on and then handed them over to Sky TV, my understanding is that that's quite a trove of almost a complete list of every foreign fighter that's joined Daesh.
Yes, I think we could exaggerate the importance, because these records relate back to a period of 2013 and early 2014, where clearly a significant number of people were joining Islamic State, but by no means as many as started joining after the declaration of the caliphate at the end of, or in the middle of 20 July. So I think that although they're hugely useful in showing the sort of people who were joining, the numbers, where they were coming from and so on, and what nationalities, have been a great help in analyzing the early days of the Islamic State, I think that it probably is no longer particularly relevant to the people who are there now. Though, having said that, I should add that some of the people who were implicated in the Brussels and Paris attacks were in that list.
Well, that was the extraordinary thing, that one of those, one of the brothers who blew himself up at the airport in Brussels, first of all, he had been convicted, given a 12-year sentence for armed robbery, where he fired at the police with a Kalashnikov, which is pretty hardcore. I think if you did that here in the United States, you'd be put away for a long time, if not shot on the spot. And then his 12-year sentence, he got out after 4 years, and then immediately went down to Syria, breaking his probation, supposedly going joining with Daesh and then coming back. The Turkish authorities alerted both the Dutch authorities, where he flew in to the Netherlands, and also the Belgium authorities, that this guy was hardcore, and nothing was done about him. So what's your understanding about, is that what Tony Blair refers to as flabby liberalism?
I wouldn't call it flabby liberalism so much as probably a certain amount of inefficiency, if you like. I think the Belgian services in particular have been absolutely overwhelmed by the size of the problem that they face there, and trying to distinguish between a mass of people who are just sort of criminals, and I agree with you, shooting at police with a Kalashnikov is a pretty serious crime, even in Belgium, and distinguishing between that group and a group of criminals who may also have extremist views. Now, the big mistake with this guy was that he was sent back by Turkey with the red flag that this man appeared to be trying to cross the border into Syria and join the Islamic State. That wasn't acted on, and that was a big mistake. But unfortunately, I think the Belgians really, for some months, just could not cope. And that guy, it was sent back in June by Turkey. And of course, it was only 9 months later that he actually mounted an attack. So even trying to keep an eye on him for all that period, albeit that he could have been prosecuted for breaking his probation, that would have been quite a task. And I think some of the European services are just not quite up to it, and they have to rethink the way they're going to approach this problem.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington, and was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations. And the other aspect, of course, is this homemade explosive, TATP, that I believe is made in the bathtub with chemicals that they're readily, or household products that are readily available. But the stench was pretty high. People could smell chemicals. It would seem, though, that since it's called the mother of Satan by those who use it, because it sometimes is so unstable, I take it that there must be some trained explosive experts in the mix there. Is that, or did they just get lucky? Because several times people have tried to make it. Even the guy that tried to blow up the LAX after 9/11, he tried to make it as well, and almost asphyxiated himself.
Yeah, indeed, it is quite a difficult substance to put together, albeit that you can get the materials relatively easily. It's very unstable, as you say. And it has to be, it does create an awful stink. It has to be dried, too, to produce amounts in the quantities you'd need for a major bomb, which is quite complicated as well, particularly in a residential setting rather than an industrial one. But there's no doubt that these people managed to do that. And the curious thing is that the guy who seems to have been the key bomb maker, whose fingerprints or whatever have been found in both Paris and in Brussels, killed himself in the explosions at Brussels Airport. So I would have thought he would be the most valuable member of the cell, and they would want to try and keep him alive to produce more stuff. But maybe that's a sign that particular cell is now exhausted. Maybe others out there, but not connected with that particular individual.
But do we know where he got his training? Because he can't just do this out of a handbook, or you know.
Well, no, you're right, and he was recorded as having been in Syria and Iraq. Yeah, you can't really do it out of a handbook. You can find out how to do it, but actually doing it, of course, you need a bit of supervision. You need someone to tell you, for God's sake, don't do that. You'll blow yourself up. Mm-hmm. I imagine that he got his training in Syria.
So just to go back to the broader front in terms of how much Daesh is being squeezed in Syria and Iraq, the Syrian government, along with Hezbollah and Russian air power, they're pretty much claiming they've taken back the ancient city of Palmyra. I don't know what state it's in. There are reports that the Daesh fighters wired all of the ruins with explosives and left snipers behind. But do you have any idea of what's going to be left?
Well, certainly we know that they blew up two rather beautiful old temples there, and they blew those up because, of course, in their view, they were for the worship of false gods, if you like, whereas the colonnade in Palmyra and lots of the other streets and lots of the other ancient ruins there, the theatre, for example, were not associated with any religious belief. So they appear to have left those relatively intact. And I do hope that's true, because it's a most magnificent site. Fortunately, within the site of Palmyra, there's just a citadel which was being used as a sort of defensive post. And the rest of the Islamic State strength, I think, was in the border of the inhabited town, which is a little way away, not very far, but a little way away from the ancient ruins themselves. So we wait to see. But, you know, this is one of the tragedies of the war, that in Syria and Iraq, so many, and in other places in West Africa and so on, so many UNESCO World Heritage sites, things that are essential to our culture and our heritage and the memory of what we were, have been destroyed.
And what's happening in Mosul? The Iraqi forces have been poised to take Mosul for the longest time, but apparently they're having problems even securing the villages on the outskirts, and the offensive seems to be floundering.
Yeah, well, there are various problems with Mosul. First of all, of course, it's a very large place, second largest city in Iraq after Baghdad. Also, it's full of people who are not particularly friendly towards the Baghdad government. You know, it's a Sunni town, the Sunni center, whereas Baghdad, of course, is using essentially Shia militia and troops that are loyal to the Baghdad government and therefore likely also to be Shia, not particularly interested in promoting the interests of the Sunni in Mosul. So that you don't have that normal sort of rear guard, fifth column group that you can call on to help your attack. Beyond that, I think because the Islamic State's been there now for 2 years almost, they have built up extremely good defences. As you were saying with Palmyra, they will have lots of hidden explosives and booby traps and that sort of thing, as well as many entrenched positions, tunnels dug between buildings, and all the things that make it urban warfare so very, very difficult. And I think that the initial assault of the Baghdad army just recently, Baghdad forces just recently, was relatively easily repulsed. So we'll see what they come up with next.
But isn't there a fear that these Shiite militias are essentially death squads, that this is not going to be very pleasant when they get in there? They're likely to be a lot of what they euphemistically call collateral damage.
I think you're right, yes. And certainly that is the fear of people in Iraq, on both sides, I should say, that these people, the Shia militia, will be essentially uncontrollable. And they're doing whatever they can. And you saw down in Ramadi that they tried to rein in the Shia militia so they wouldn't go in and start looting and pillaging and beating up the Sunni population there. I mean, this whole thing of hearts and minds, it's interesting that the Islamic State has been able to stay in those areas of Syria and Iraq, not because they offer good governance necessarily or you know, particularly welcomed by the people, but just because they're better than the alternative, which is Bashar al-Assad or the Baghdad Shia-dominated government in Iraq.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Richard Barrett.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. And again, I've been speaking with Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington, and was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back looking into the critical races primaries scheduled for a week from Tuesday in Wisconsin. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Joel Rogers, who's a professor of law, political science, public affairs, and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he also directs COWS, the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. Joel Rogers has written widely on American politics and public policy, and is most recently the author of American Society, How It Really Works. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joel Rogers.
Good to be here, Ian.
And Joel, it looks as though Wisconsin is emerging as a very key primary state with the elections a week from Tuesday. It's sort of shaping up, I think, as a must-win for both Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz. But there's also, of course, the state's favorite son, Paul Ryan, who is coyly waiting in the wings. There's a possibility he may emerge as the solution to the panicked Republican establishment's painful choices as they find themselves torn between the unlikable Cruz and the uncontrollable Trump. So let's start.
Certainly his fervent hope.
So you think that the recent speech that that Paul Ryan gave to the interns, where he didn't mention Trump by name, but talked about how the discourse has gone into the gutter and how we should elevate our sights a little. That wasn't entirely accidental. You think he's laying the groundwork for a run?
Yeah, with the same cheerful duplicity that he did for taking over the House speakership and other things in his long career. Yeah.
So I take it, though, that probably what's happening is that the members of on the Republican side in the House and probably in the Senate as well are just terrified that the down ticket, down ballot damage that Trump would bring would possibly have the Democrats take over, certainly the Senate and even possibly the House. Is that what he's hearing, Paul Ryan? They're going to him and saying, you got to do something?
I think that's basically it. You know, splitting your ticket has declined a lot in American politics in the last 10, 15 years. People tend to do much more straight-line ticket voting now than in the past. And the worry is, as expressed to me by two or three of the remaining Republican Congress people talking, is that we'll just get washed away with a bunch of new people coming in voting for Trump in the national election and not shifting over for respecting us in the splitting the tickets appropriately. So they want to make sure that, it's sort of complicated. Let's say you're a Republican. You want to vote for Trump. You like your local Republican. Let's say Trump doesn't get elected. If Trump does get elected, then, the number of you is going to be quite small relative to the rest of the country. Then you have the Republican disaster that you're describing, electoral disaster that you're describing. If it's Ryan, what happens? Then if Trump goes third party, then as we were discussing earlier, that means the election gets thrown into the House. Either way, Ryan is going to be benefiting from this. He benefits at this point from as much disorder as he can possibly find, because you don't want the case. The only thing he wants to prevent is a Democrat actually winning.
But is there a possibility that, given the tenor of this campaign, with this week of charges and countercharges in the National Enquirer saying that Ted Cruz had affairs with five women, and then Ted Cruz coming out shaking his finger at the camera and saying, Donald, you can't go after my wife, that kind of ridiculous
right.
stuff, that's the sort of that this is the nature of this year. It's just not going to get any better. And just as every time Cruz takes on Trump, he nevertheless gets slimed. Is that possible that Ryan would sort of say to himself, "My God, we're all going to be tainted this year, and it's better for me to stay out."
I don't think he's too worried about taint. I think he's worried about the Republicans' position in Congress. I don't think he's too worried about being tainted. He can make up budgets, and people describe him as a genius of the federal budget. The press in general, you and a few others being prominent exceptions, conflict driven, lazy, sensationalist, etc. They don't do the hard work to actually investigate his record. It's easier to elevate him as a great pundit of the public fisc, and I he'll be safe in his own district where he remains quite popular. I think he's fine. What he's worried about is his position within the House and then the future of the Republican Party. He certainly wants to run for president at some point again. He ran for vice president once. He's respected in the party, blah, blah, blah. So he's just doing the political game. He's not too worried about his own immediate future that way.
So
I don't know if I answered your question, but
yeah.
I don't think he's worried about himself. He's worried about himself to the extent that his self depends upon the strength of the party. And the party's strength could be threatened by Trump actually being the leader of the party, the nominee of the party. If Trump goes third party, though, then the strength of the party is the party's in great shape, because they will then, the House Republicans will effectively choose the next president. And that's a tremendous, you know, a tremendously compromising for Trump bargaining posture to be in. It's not clear how much he can threaten the third-party route because they would welcome that. They would welcome, you know, Hillary getting 40% and then two slightly nutcase people, you know, one officially the nominee of the party, the other being Donald Trump, you know, splitting the rest, and then you throw it into the House, where they control, obviously.
Well, I would think just in terms of the current job that Paul Ryan has.
And it's the old House, by the way. It's not the new House. It's not the House that's elected in that election. It's the old House.
The old House gets to vote, right.
The old House gets to vote, and they've got that old House locked down.
Right, and in terms of the current job that Ryan has, it's no fun being in the minority, right?
No.
So what do you think is happening then on the just in terms of the – I imagine the state's getting barraged, right, with ads. You could probably round the clock, right?
You know, I'm sorry to sound like a professor who doesn't watch TV, but I actually don't watch a lot of you know, mainstream TV. I'm guilty as much as anyone of you know, binge watching, you know, episodes of I don't know, whatever, you know, some vehicle or another. But I don't actually, I have not seen a bunch of ads. But I'm the wrong guy to ask.
Sure. Well,
Bernie Sanders was in town yesterday. Did a big event. I wasn't there, but I hear, you know, thousands and thousands of very enthusiastic, largely young people were there at the Alliance Center here in Madison. I'm not sure how he's going to do. I don't think he knows either. I'm not sure if it's actually make or break for Bernie, but all the states from here on out are obviously important, extremely important to him. He's got to do, you know, extremely well, basically, in every state that remains of any significant population. And we're a mid-sized state, but we've got a few million people around. So we'll have some, you know, some electoral votes to cast and certainly a fair number of delegates.
Well, I think it's very much a make or break for Cruz, though, isn't it? I mean, Cruz
yes,
is...
Yes. That I firmly agree with.
Right. And then that brings us to your governor. I don't mean to make you responsible for Scott Walker, but
it is my state. I vote regularly.
Right. Yeah. Well, he of course, was absolutely trounced in the elections, but the press are giving him some authority in terms of who he endorses in this race. And the expectation is he will endorse Cruz, although I believe Kasich is wooing him. Does Scott Walker count? Is he that important still?
You know, actually, I had not followed that, and I don't think that counts a great deal, even with the Republican base. Now, why do I say that? Because people are not crazy about Walker or Walker's judgment, certainly based on all the missteps he made in the, you know, in the aborted presidential run. What they like Walker for is simply that he is going to reliably hurt poor people and really screw unions. That's his only attraction. He's done almost nothing else as governor, as you must know. The state is still in very sad economic shape. It's going down in all sorts of ways. But Walker is prized by his base. So far as I know, and they do admire him. They admire him for standing up to poor people and standing up to unions and standing up to the university. You know, these are all not particularly formidable, you know, enemies to stand up to, but people have the impression that poor people are getting, you know, are ripping them off in different ways. Unions are, you know, making them bundles somehow or other, and the teachers and people at universities are, you know, basically to be slapped back. His attack on the university is particularly important because I think on almost any account, even, you know, even from the far right reaches of the business establishment, the University of Wisconsin is a real gem for the state and the whole university system. It's a tremendous source of economic wealth for the state. So for him going against it is, you know, purely ideological. It's not even really, you know, supporting his business folks.
Isn't there a personal animus in that?
He says, look, I want you to vote for Kasich, or right. I want you to vote for Ted Cruz. I don't think the Republican base that's going to show up is going to be particularly, they'd be interested in what he had to say and why he was saying that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he has any sort of, lockjaw like control over their voting at all.
Well, we know that he sort of takes his orders from the Koch brothers, and
right.
I think he's
right.
got a kind of personal animus towards academia because he himself didn't go to college, and the Koch brothers are clearly determined to turn the American people into passive consumers, not active citizens. And the whole point of education, in many ways, is to prepare you for citizenship, not necessarily prepare you for a job, which is not, you know, particularly much on the horizon, at any rate, for all these indebted kids that we have today living at home.
Right, right. Well, you know, as Richard Rorty used to joke, you know, the purpose of a liberal arts education is to produce more tax and spend liberals. And certainly, you know, he sort of knows that, or he certainly knows the university, you know, stands for principles of independent inquiry, which is why he tried to get that out of the charge to the university, and then claimed he hadn't tried to do it, and so on. Yeah, he really hates people at the university, hates them with an almost personal passion. Every time I see Robin Voss as his assembly speaker, you know, they say, "Oh, we're going to get you, Joel. We're going to get you." That may be to me personally, but yeah, they do not consider the university a friend and are trying to do everything possible to helped along by the new university president, Cross, to make people here more frightened of speaking out politically and just degrade the quality of their work experience so far as possible. And then, you know, he's not so crazy about the elementary school teachers either, as you know from the deep cuts in education
sure.
that presided over. Some of that may come back to actually haunt him, although, like, like our famous senator from Kentucky, he's able to sort of disguise what he's doing enough. The process is complicated enough. He can both claim in public, as he has, that he's a big supporter of rural schools, and then basically preside over very, very deep cuts. And in a lot of the rural counties in Wisconsin, you know, the factories are gone. A lot of the other stuff is gone. The schools are really the thing that they're most interested, that is really the center of the communities. And the consolidation and cutbacks in the schools has really degraded the quality of life in those counties. Those same people think that Walker is their friend, even though he's tearing the guts out of a lot of their counties. But, you know, that's the cleverness of political lying.
Well, just in the last minute, Joel Rogers, is Wisconsin...
Well, one tiny thing for you. One tiny, tiny thing for you. Yeah, but go ahead.
I was going to say that is there a possible shift underway? I mean, after all, you've got the former Senator Russ Feingold running again. Johnson is a complete catastrophe. And, you know, even though they lost in recall, my sense is that the left in Wisconsin is getting its act together and is back in the fight, or am I just being wildly optimistic?
Well, I think there's certainly rational hope that the left in Wisconsin or progressives in Wisconsin or Wisconsinites generally are going to get their act a little bit more together. I'm less upbeat about Wisconsin than I am other parts of the country. I moved here because I wanted to be in this great university, in a state capital with good town-gown relations, in a state with a superabundant, and a town in particular with a superabundant supply of public goods, largely consumable by children, and then all the rest of it, the beauty of the place, et cetera, was, you know, an add-on. You know, the quality of those public goods has really declined. There's no question about it. And people are very, very insecure. That could lead to, you know, pitchforks or some other populist protest, or it could lead to what it has led to here, which is just, you know, very much lowered expectations. Role of politicians is to lower expectations even faster than they disappoint them. Lower expectations, and then, you know, another person at the university, Kathy Kramer, has a book out coming out on the politics of resentment. A bunch of people who just want to screw or so. Feel so fleeced and mauled over by what's happened to them. They just want to rage out at others, but with absolutely no confidence in government as in any way, even potentially their friend. Mm-hmm. So that's the politics. You know, I could see it going down to sort of Arkansas type levels of degradation rather than up. Well, Wisconsin has always been, you know, a little bit, I don't know, bivalent in his mm-hmm. politics. You know, you have Joe McCarthy. That drunk is, you know, probably.
Right. And then you had La Follette on the other side, right?
Well, yeah, but you also had Tommy Thompson at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, Proxmire, and you have Feingold at the same time as other people.
Joel, we've run out of time, but I really appreciate you joining us. I'm very grateful. And again, I've been speaking with Joel Rogers. He's a professor of law, political science, public affairs, and sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he also directs COWS. He's written widely on American politics and public policy, and his latest book is American Society, How It Really Works. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into what happened to It's the Economy, Stupid, in this election.
A pound, a mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound is all that makes the world go round. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and was previously the Chief Economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and of the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Pleasure to be here.
And normally, in politics, and particularly in presidential years, the refrain comes back, it's the economy, stupid. But I don't see that this year. There hasn't been much of an emphasis on the economy from anybody, except Donald Trump, of course. His solution to both the domestic economy and foreign policy is just to make better deals, but certainly no specifics. So what's your sense of what specifics there are out there, either from Clinton, Sanders, Trump, or even Cruz?
Well, I think what's innovative about this political season is that people are not really focused on one or another policy in the economic realm. They're focused on what you might call the system of representation, particularly as it relates to what people call a plutocracy or money politics. The question is, can we achieve good policy? And Bernie Sanders, in particular, is raising this critique, saying, if the system of representation is all about money, then money and wealth being concentrated means very few people will be represented in our society. And you'll see things like the healthcare system, which is 38th best in the world, ranked by the World Health Organization, and at the same time costs more than double what anybody else in an advanced economy, so-called OECD economy, is asked to pay. You see pharmaceutical prices very high. You see things like public schools and infrastructure devastated, just broken down. So human needs for a broad base of the population are not being achieved, and certain what you might call monopolies are being fortified. Antitrust is not being enforced. The financial sector is getting more concentrated and larger. And the critique, as Bernie Sanders and some others, even Trump, talk about is the game is rigged. And you're not going to get good results until you change how the game is set up. And I think there's a very broad portion of the American people, many of whom have experienced deteriorating living standards in the last 20 years, who are what you might call resonating with that message, are very attracted to those candidates.
But the two candidates who bring up, in a sense, the same issue, that the game is rigged, their solutions, for as much as they've been enunciated, couldn't be more different.
That's right.
I mean, isn't that the extraordinary part, that Donald Trump basically identifies the problem that you've been screwed, but blames it on immigrants and Mexicans and, yes, and Muslims, etc., and also calls for a trade war with China, which also, to some extent, Bernie Sanders is not calling for a trade war, but he's certainly calling for overhauling these deals like NAFTA and TPP, etc. So what explains that extraordinary difference?
Well, I think one is that Senator Sanders has worked in the legislature, and he understands a lot about the process, and he understands the systems of checks and balances between the different aspects of government, executive branch, the courts, and legislature. The other is that Trump, who I'm not a Trump fan, I have to say, but he does talk about pharmaceutical prices and big banks and other things as being outrageous. So he does identify some of these economic problems. But his solution, as you rightly say, is to displace focus on cause onto all kinds of people, like Muslims or what have you, that, how would I say, this is not a healthy direction, and it's a distraction from the underlying problems. But what Trump does, like Sanders, is identify that the system is broken. If that's your starting point, people will listen to you. If people will say, quote, there's not much we can do, there is no alternative, that so-called TINA, there is no alternative policy that started with Margaret Thatcher, creates a sense of inevitable demise, and people will tune out on that. So it's these two candidates who embrace the need for transformation, for a different mode of social sustainability, and I think that's why they're catching fire when many of the others are, still in the game, but not creating the emotional intensity that those two do.
So given that this is the year of the outsider, and I think status quo politicians like Hillary Clinton, who say, you know, essentially want to improve the system, are just not getting anywhere compared to Bernie Sanders, who wants to change the system. So clearly the young people get it because they're not living the American dream. They're living an indentured kind of servitude at home with dim job prospects and huge debts. So they seem to get it. But given that the awareness is out there, that Bernie Sanders has opened a number of people's eyes and consciousness, and they're getting aboard, the next step seems extremely fuzzy to me. I mean, what are the actual solutions? And if you can get, and he, of course, he did very well yesterday in the primaries. He's got a pretty difficult road. He's got to do over 60%, I think, in all of the subsequent races. But nevertheless, I don't see Hillary Clinton offering the solutions that you're talking about, which is, having identified the problem, then how do you essentially turn America back from a plutocracy to a democracy?
Right. First of all, I think you're identifying exactly the fulcrum of this debate, which is improving the system from within, particularly in the name of a family, the Clintons, that's already been in power over the period of NAFTA, financial deregulation. It's hard for people to believe, even if Hillary is very well-intentioned and if she's very sophisticated, as I think she is, about the process of change, the probability of change working within the system is unsatisfying to many who are despairing, particularly, as you mentioned, the young people, where education has ceased to be what you might call the rung in the ladder of opportunity, and instead it's become a toll gate where great indebtedness and great rises in tuition are used as what you might call the pass key to even participating in the prospect of well-being in our society. It's a mess. So I look at the problem is that Bernie Sanders is an idealist. He prescribes policies like free college tuition, like single-payer medical insurance and things that are not pipe dreams. They're in evidence in other countries like Germany and France and the UK and other places. But the feasibility of getting them done in America, given the plutonomy, makes them look like pipe dreams. And the people who are attracted to working with Hillary Clinton see incremental change within a system that isn't going to change, but she's, how would I say, pushing the needle towards better, and a lot of those people are also filled with dread of Donald Trump or Ted Cruz being the alternative, as they call it, the least worst strategy. And so there are people who will argue that things are intractable, but working within an intractable system at the margins, much as Obama did, is the best we can do. Now, to come more to the heart of your question, I think Bernie Sanders' critique that a platonomy is not going to produce good results is correct. I think large institutional concentrations of power, lack of enforcement of antitrust while we worship the market, these kinds of what you might call refractions from even sound economic thinking are tantamount to, how do I say, immiseration of a large portion of the population. Trade agreements like TPP that are organized, negotiated, and delivered as a fait accompli by corporate lobbyists are not something where the public participated in the ritual, regardless of how complicated or sophisticated. It's just kind of thumbing your nose at the democratic process. So I think the pressures and the hostility and the fear are continuing to mount what I will call something that is socially unsustainable. And I think seeing the vitality of Trump, seeing Bernie Sanders' critique, is shaking people up. And even if Hillary Clinton is elected, I think people are going to have to wonder if the next step, if they breathe the sigh of relief that someone like her beats Trump in a general election, the next step is how are they going to stop from coming back to this place? There's a lot of information in this election season about how disgruntled the American public is. And when I talk to essentially elite people from all over the world, from Great Britain, France, Germany, I was just in China, they're horrified what's happening, but they don't see it as what you might call ephemeral. They see it as a prelude to a very troubled time in the United States.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz and was the Chief Economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. But at the end of the day, though, people are right to be outraged at how they've basically been downsized. And the U.S. history seems to fluctuate between some sort of faltering form of social democracy and then going back to plutonomy, you know, starting back with the Gilded Age and then mm-hmm. the Depression and then starting with Reagan, the vestiges of the New Deal have been rolled back. I mean, prior to Reagan, banks used to pay interest and now they charge interest. And everybody is their standard of living has been kept artificially high by credit, but not by the wages haven't gone up in over 30 years. So the statistics are pretty clear of how much the average person's being hosed, but whether they get it or not, whether they're going to, you know, fall for the promises that Donald Trump will make you all a millionaire and you'll all win the lottery with him. I guess at the end of the day, my question would be, clearly to me, the elite in this country have become incredibly insular, incredibly selfish, and that Wall Street is more about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. And I don't see that being sustainable over the long term. And the evisceration of education seems to be the most counterintuitive thing you could imagine. But education, you know, was also not about getting a job, but also about becoming a citizen. And it seems to me that what's happened to the country is that there's been an effort to move us away from being active citizens into sort of passive consumers. But now they don't even provide you with the purchasing power to be a consumer.
That's right. I think the types of dread that you're talking about are a prelude to, a despair and a frustration that leads to submission to authoritarian charismatics like Mussolini, like Donald Trump. And I don't think that leads to any good. And this is what I think really should scare elites in America, is that authoritarian, which you might call magic attraction, is ephemeral and then leads to either oppression or very substantial revolt. Ian, one of the really great books that's been written in the last couple of years was written here in California, a woman named Wendy Brown, and her book is called Undoing the Demos. And it describes in great detail with regard to education, with regard to the arts, with regard to public infrastructure, and with regard to making the medical system a way to extract wealth from people, like you described in finance. Rather than taking care of people, it's using the misfortune that people have when they get ill to back them up against the wall and extract wealth from them. And Wendy's book is a beautiful portrait, somewhat difficult read, but a beautiful portrait of how disintegration is taking place under the aegis of economic logic to rationalize each of these things. But it doesn't look like a sustainable system. It doesn't look like a system that you or I want to hand to our children or our grandchildren. And I think, how would I say it, it's very, very dangerous right now. This is what I think the elites and everybody else are sensing. It's very dangerous when authoritarian candidates with no structural model or vision, no experience in the realm of governance, start to offer these authoritarian charismatic fantasies and they catch fire with the public. That tells you about the depth of despair.
And you mentioned you just got back from China, Rob Johnson. Let's talk a little bit about China, because on the foreign policy front, we could blunder into a new Cold War with China, and there is obviously a division within China itself between those that are wanting more and more integration with the global economy and, to some extent, President Xi, who came of age during the Red Guard period, who is something of an ideologue. And it seems to me that the greatest tragedy of all was if the U.S. starts to sort of bait the Chinese into an arms race. And that has to be avoided at all costs, surely.
Yes. I think right now, which you might call the fulcrum of the transformation of this planet and its mode of, how you say, economic existence and social existence, is centered on the challenges in China. I just came back from there. I watched Henry Kissinger, of all people, give a very, very profound talk about the dangers of a new Cold War, and the greatest harm that could be done to the world would be if the kind of bellicose utterances, say, that Trump emits about China, or the Council on Foreign Relations has just issued a very nationalistic report, or the TPP, or the Congress stopping China from being involved in the IMF in a, how you say, a degree and proportion that their size and scale justifies. All of these things may inspire China, which can no longer rely on export-led growth to the stagnant advanced nations like the United States and Europe. This may inspire China to use military Keynesianism, just as we did after the Depression at the prelude to World War II, in order to rebuild the economy, and that would be dreadful. The Chinese could build an education system that is much more formidable, much like the heyday of the California university system. The Chinese could transform the environment with an energy like a Green New Deal that would make a tremendous difference, not only to their health and well-being, but to the world's well-being. But the Chinese right now can use their fiscal capacities for augmenting what they call their human capital, in other words, the knowledge base and knowledge quality of their body politic, and their physical health, and make great strides that benefit them and the world. The alternative trajectory, as Kissinger warned, is this dreadful Cold War, and given the, what you might call, power in our plutonomy, in our, we might call, reliance on fear, ordnance, and the military, I think it's very dangerous, because I could see the United States almost pathologically joining this military spiral and each country egging the other on until we do come to a world war. Not next month, not next year, but in a 15 to 20 year horizon, that that negative trajectory could be dreadful. And I do see some, symptoms that suggest to me we're going to have to work very hard to resist inspiring the Chinese to move towards that nationalistic military mode of thinking. As you mentioned, Xi Jinping is like a throwback to Mao. Frank Decotter's got a beautiful new book coming out in May on the Cultural Revolution, and you can see the parallels with that very, very awful period to what's happening in the consolidation of power in the Chinese government. But we must remember Mao was there to, he inspired the Chinese population to follow him because of the threat of imperialist intrusion by the Japanese, and of course before that the British Empire. So the nationalist feeling runs very deep within China, and allowing Xi Jinping to seize on that is, America and perhaps other parts of the world contributing to a very, very dreadful scenario.
Well, just in closing, I mean, clearly we've seen this bad movie before with the Soviet, with the arms race with the Soviet Union, where to some extent we created our own nemesis. So what's your sense of the symbiosis between the hawks on their side and the hawks on our side versus the doves on their side and the doves on our side?
Well, your multilateral globalists would argue that commerce, the prospect of the next engine of growth being the Chinese middle class, could lead to a very strong coalition who are largely engaged in foreign direct investment or building up foreign participation in the Chinese economy, would be the coalition that would offset these military ambitions and offset the hawks and their attempt to warmonger. The big problem right now is, I think, in this nationalistic period within China, many foreign businessmen are feeling very frustrated. They feel like they share technology, they participate in the business, but they come out with no profit. All the profit is garnered by the Chinese in what feels like a corrupt commercial system. So I don't think, I think at this point, a thawing on both sides is necessary. And like I mentioned, a transformation towards these services like education and health, a transformation towards renewing the base of energy production, which will help Los Angeles air pollution, not just Beijing or Shanghai's. But I think it's going to take a lot of work and very deep cooperation. In that regard, I think Kissinger's warning at the China Development Forum, which I attended, was very well founded.
Well, Robert Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, as always.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, who's the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. He served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz, and previously was the Chief Economist of the U.S. Senate Banking Committee and the U.S. Senate Budget Committee. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.